Hey everybody, JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce back. Another of the Baseball America Prospect Podcast deep dives, and today we are covering the Houston Astros. Got a little theme here. We did the Tampa Bay Rays, which you may have enjoyed, that we just dropped on the YouTube channel and our podcast feed, and now we're covering another team that was involved in that trade because we're covering the Houston Astros, which have a little bit of a reshaped top 10 as well, including a new number one prospect because, you know, again, well, before we get into the prospects, Jeff, kind of lay out, if you would, a little bit of good to see you as always, but lay out like what the Astros got back here and how significant that might be to their big league club in 2026.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we looked at after the last World Series championship in 2022 was the amount of talented young starters that they had some runway in terms of control. Unfortunately for them, those have been kind of, you know, not across the board. Hunter Brown has been tremendous, has turned into a potential, you know, front of the rotation type starter. I don't know if I want to say ace yet, but he's a one or a two, I think, in most organizations. He's been a great development, of course. They've always have a couple other arms that leak in there. But these guys, there were a lot of injuries. Luis Garcia hasn't pitched for effectively a few years now. Christian Javier came back last year after missing, you know, large chunks of the last 2 years. And, you know, I think you look at a Lance McCullers and some of these other guys, and it's clear that there's some injury risk. McCullers was present a few years ago, even when they were winning titles, of course. But the depth became an issue. And I think that's one of the reasons they went out and they signed Tetsuya Amai out of Japan, which I think you could argue was potentially the top available NPB player on the market, either him or Okamoto. You know, they go out and they make this trade for Mike Burrows, who had kind of an under the radar, really good season for the Pirates last year. There's obviously some other bigger names in that Pirates rotation and guys that came up from the minors that maybe got more attention. But Burrows, you know, since coming back from injury, there were a lot of relief questions. I think he's kind of answered those questions a little bit. He looks like a starter going forward. So they were able to trade out a few of their more desirable prospects in Melton and Anderson Brito and, you know, acquire Burrows, strengthen up that rotation. And, you know, depending on how you see Ryan Weiss, who they had signed out of the KBO, how you sort of view him, you know, there's maybe five or six options here in this rotation. One of those options, of course, being Lance McCullers, which we could only count on so many innings with McCullers. But I do think that what it did is that it helped them reinforce sort of the middle to the back end of that rotation. And then the Amai signing kind of firmed up, you know, the shape of that group going into the season, because it was of a concern. It was something that I think dragged them down a little bit. Is it the lineup of 2017 to 2022? Probably not, but you know, a bounce back season.
I'm going to take the probably out of that. Like, cause the probably is not, it's like, okay, Carlos Correa is not the same Carlos Correa as then. Jose Altuve is not the same Jose Altuve. Kyle Tucker's gone. Alex Bregman's gone. Yeah. Even if Jeremy Pena continues to, you know, blossom and all that, Jordan Alvarez comes back fully healthy, it's still not going to be that lineup, because that lineup was just incredible.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it can still be a pretty good lineup. There's still some questions, I think, in terms of their outfield depth. You know, some of that's going to come down to, you know, whether it's Cam Smith out there, Jake Myers, Zach Cole. You know, they obviously traded for Jesus Sanchez as well, who I think does have some upside. Christian Walker had a down year. Like, even Yarner Diaz. Like, I think that there's enough offensive firepower within the lineup to compete, particularly if they are able to go out and maybe get another bat here. And we'll see, you know, what takes shape between now and the end of the season. So, yeah, it's not the same Astros team that it was, but I think it would be wrong to say that they won't be competitive or have a chance in the AL West this year. I still have some belief that they can probably do that.
So that leads us into the first question we've been asking on all of these. And in this case, when you say how difficult was the decision to rank Xavier Nyans at one, the answer is very difficult earlier on, because at the time we did the prospect handbook, Jacob Melton was the number one. And by the way, Anderson Brito, who's no longer on this list because that same trade was number three. So we will focus it on Nyans now, but obviously we will also acknowledge that this is a new number one because of the trade. But what led, you know, beyond the fact that a trade moved him to number one, what stood out Nyans when you compare him to the rest of the guys who, you know, the Ethan Frey or, you know, a Bryce Matthews, AJ Blueball, the other guys who were kind of in that same range of consideration?
Yeah. And I think this is the kind of system, and it's been this way for a lot of years, that depending upon the organization you're talking to and the evaluator that you're having a conversation with, whether it's internally or externally, you can get this list laid out a variety of different ways, whether it's the top five or the top 10. There were people internally that I spoke with, and then on the amateur side externally, because obviously they're the only ones that would have gotten real looks on Xavier Nyans, that argued that he could be the number one prospect in the system when Melton and Brito were still in the system. There were teams that, you know, had valued Brito after seeing him in the AFL and doing some work on him. They viewed him as the number one player in the system. But more often than not, the consensus tended to lie with Jacob Melton, a guy who was barely eligible for the prospect handbook. Now that we've sort of changed, you know, our regulations based on service time versus just hard at bat counts and hard innings pitch counts. I believe it was a day, JJ. I believe it was one day that he qualified as a prospect in the handbook. We had to double check it. We had to call external teams and double check our work to make sure that he was actually eligible, but he was just eligible, but he's not PPI eligible, which I think is kind of an interesting wrinkle in all this. That said, a guy that's been in the big leagues, he's really hit at every level. Is it always the loudest production? No. But I think we've seen progression with him as a hitter. There's enough contact skills there to not, you know, think that it's going to completely bottom out. There's always been some approach. He's speedy. He hits the ball hard. The angles aren't always great. But a guy that puts the ball in play, has the plays to make it work with his legs. And depending upon who you talk to, you know, you will get some guys that think he's maybe a 60 out there in center field long term. 55 tended to be more what I was getting. But a guy that can play all three outfield positions, has experience at all three outfield positions. The throwing is pretty good. So I think overall, like, you know, Melton was the one at that point in time. Nyans was close. And when we talk about Nyans, we talk about a guy that, you know, some prep hit tool questions, which can go a variety of ways, right? We've seen the Roman Anthony's and the Connor Griffins, which are guys that had different types of hit tool questions between the two of them, but hit tool questions nonetheless. And then we've seen, you know, the opposite side of that with, you know, a guy like, now it was granted, it was a small sample, but like a guy like Ethan Holiday, who I think is, you know, kind of a contemporary of Nyans, a guy that really struggled with contact in his debut. So maybe it's of a benefit. I think we certainly saw this with the Pirates of Connor Griffin and Roman Anthony to an extent, of him having sort of that backfield work, them being able to, you know, sort of work out the kinks in the swing, whatever the things are that they feel they need to make adjustments on to get him making more contact. Because when he makes more contact, it is outlier power. It is 70 grade raw. And I will say amongst the amateur community, the consistent comp that I got was Roman Anthony, that there's a lot of similarities. Now, different positions. He's not a shortstop long-term, probably a third baseman, but a really big arm, a lot of power, kind of fits, you know, that prototypical third baseman, you know, sort of outline. So it'll be interesting to see how it all progresses and the type of player that we have next year. But I do think this is the first time in a while that I could come into a season and truly say that the Astros had a player who could go from outside the list to the top 50 if he really produces. And, you know, whether it's Drew Gilbert, whether it's Ryan Clifford, when he had his breakout, of course, Melton, they haven't really had that guy as long as I've been doing the system for 4 years now. And I think you could probably even go back five or six.
Now that is something, like you said, that's not been a big kind of, attribute of theirs. And the system that hasn't had a ton of top 100 caliber prospects in recent years doesn't have, again, you know, we are rolling out our top 100 very shortly. I will just give you the little sneak peek without giving anything away to say, don't expect to see a lot of Astros on this top 100 right now. As you said, guys who could move up. And I do think that, to just kind of ask you with that, to follow up on that, Ethan Frey, who's number two on this list, is another guy who I don't think there was in any way, there's not really any way that you were going to compare him and to Jacob Melton at that moment and say, oh, I'm going to take the guy who's hasn't really had a whole lot of chance to play in the outfield too much recently, you know, in LSU because of a shoulder injury, has had some injuries, but, you know, shown production as well, but just starting his pro career versus the guy who's literally been in the big leagues and plays all three outfield positions as well. But now if you compare him to Nyans, Nyans has more upside, but it would not be, it's not crazy to think that Ethan Frey could end up being the more productive player either, right?
No, not at all. And I think especially, and we talked to him on the Hot Sheet show a week or two back, I think especially, you know, now that he is getting more outfield work, kind of getting those reps back in, there's a better athlete in there than I think a lot of people had anticipated. And just in terms of the bat, this was one of the loudest post-draft performances. I think I probably had two of them in my systems, Kane Kepley with the Cubs, which it was in a very different manner in which he was impressive. And then Ethan Frey. And the thing that I love about Frey, and he kind of falls into that wheelhouse of like my personal cheese ball type of player. And that is, he's a guy who makes a ton of end zone contact. The swing decisions are really good. Maybe a little bit passive, but enough that he's never going to overexpose himself in the zone. And when he does make contact, he makes some of the hardest contact of, you know, really any player in professional baseball. His 90th, now granted it was 122 plate appearances, so this could tick down a little bit, but it was a 108.3 90th percentile EV. He had a 114 ball in play. The angles are pretty good. The pull air could get a little bit better, but he finds the barrel consistently and he makes that contact, you know, in zone whiff rate. Once again, low A, he played in the SEC, so we take it with a grain of salt, but 15.4%, that's what we wanted. That's the kind of performance we want to see that's probably, you know, going to continue to be sustainable as he gets up to higher levels. And I wouldn't even be shocked if, you know, this is a 1 month in Asheville and then, you know, he's in Corpus Christi by May. I think you look at this player, you look at the upside, when you consider how big the power is, that's another thing about this current Astro system that I like better than maybe some of the guys that the years past. This is a guy that we could be talking about as a top 100 prospect come June. You know, if he really hits in Asheville, which I would expect he's going to really hit in Asheville, right? There's not a lot of guys that don't. And then gets up to Corpus Christi and continues to perform, then that answers a lot of the sort of age to level questions and prior experience questions and all that sort of stuff. And I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, just the type of damage that he does, the quality of the contact and the swing decisions. More often than not, when guys show this in their pro debut, it's pretty sticky.
I'm just going to ask that question just to lay it out for people. A 108, 90 EV is excellent for any level of, with a wood bat, that's just an excellent 90 percentile exit velocity. There's not a curve there where you're going, okay, well, you need to see him do more. No, if he just could do that in the major leagues, he's going to be a really good player. Like, just
yeah, and those numbers in terms of EV, that stuff sustains at like, you know, 60 to 70 balls in play, which he far exceeded. So, you know, it's already at a level where, you know, it's
you feel pretty good about. Yeah,
we can feel pretty decent about it, even if it ticks down to a 107 or a 106.8. Still really good power.
Still really good. Second question with that. So how is this system better or worse than last year? You've already kind of laid out a couple of different ways that it's better. I would say overall, just kind of ask that question. Do you feel like it's a better system than it was this year, or post this trade, which did take away prospects number one and number three and a little bit of the kind of fast moving close to the majors guys, did that kind of knock it back down a little bit?
Yeah. You know, I think, in a vacuum, it did. In the short term, it did. I think we could look back a year from now and say, this system was better than maybe we thought it was because these players performed. I do think there's still a lot of upside guys in this top 10. We can talk about some of those. You see some of the names at the bottom of the screen. Kevin Alvarez was one of the top players in the DSL. They haven't had, you know, a international position player that really has broken out in quite a long time, especially one that they signed themselves. So I think that's one to maybe keep an eye on. And I think you look at a guy like Ryan Forcucci, who, you know, hasn't pitched yet professionally. We can get into that a little bit later. We talk about some sleepers or some breakouts. But a guy that's going to have a full healthy offseason and be ready to go next year. And there are a lot of people on the amateur side that felt prior to his injury, in early in 2024, that he was maybe a first round type talent, and a guy that really would have performed out there on the West Coast with the competition that he was facing. Really interesting stuff, maybe even more higher upside than a lot of the Astros guys that we've seen over the last couple of years that have broken out as pitchers and gotten to the major leagues very quickly. But a few of those guys were already in the system. I do think it's a little bit better. I think this was a better draft class. I think the fact that, I guess this time last year, Kevin Alvarez had technically signed, was a late addition. And I don't think we really necessarily had a great grasp. We knew we got a lot of money. We didn't have a great grasp, especially as a player out of Cuba, as to what he was going to look like. And I think right now it's trending in the right direction, even with the loss of Jacob Melton, which, by the way, he could have graduated without an injury and wouldn't even have been on inside the top 10. And then an Anderson Brito was a guy who's shown flashes. He's still a 5'10" right-hander. And I think there's a lot of questions on just how physically he's going to sustain over the rigors of potentially being a starter. So I wouldn't take that as, huge losses, though I do think they are certainly losses to the depth. It would have been a much more clear answer of yes, if those guys were still in the system. But I do think there's a lot of upside, and it's upside that seems like it's on the precipice of potential breakouts. And I can't say that was something that I felt when doing this system last season.
So that kind of does kind of lead us into the next one too, which is, so this is the case. Sometimes we have guys who are number one and you're like, oh, he's going to graduate. We know there's no scenario in any scenario where Xavier Nyens graduates. So he's obviously logically in the pole position to be next year's number one, because you have him number one right now. And barring the significant emergence of someone else or a step back from him, logically, he should still be the number one prospect. This is not an Astros team. They're going to draft higher than they do in most, but this is not an Astros team that is going to be having a top two, top three, top pick, where you're like, oh, well, they're just going to land him there, a number one prospect. So assuming Nyens, you think Nyens has what do you think the odds are that Nyens is the number one, and who are the other players who could kind of compete with him to be that top prospect a year from now?
Yeah, I think we've talked a little bit about some of those guys already, but, I would probably put it on like a 70% chance that it's Nyens. That's the number one going into next year. As we said, he's not going to graduate. Even if he had the most storybook season, he has a Connor Griffin type season. Connor Griffin's still a prospect, right? After having that season. And the Astros certainly aren't a team that would force that guy up. He's not going to do that. I'm almost positive he's not going to do that. It's less than 1% that he would. But I do think that he could produce enough. It's the 17th pick in the draft that they have. So yeah, they didn't make the playoffs. They're drafting earlier than they've drafted in a very long time. But it's not the kind of pick, even in a good draft, it's not the kind of pick that's going to net a no doubt number one. That said, I think there's three other guys here that have logical case. We talked about Ethan Frey and we talked about his skills. I don't think I have to be redundant in that sense. If he hits and he really performs, makes a big jump and is in AAA and puts up good AAA numbers before the end of the year and looks like a guy that, hey, he could break camp next year, or he could be in the mix in May of 2027. There's a very reasonable case that he could be the number one prospect going into next year.
He'll have proximity. He'll have more upper level production. Those are things that we look at when we talk about this.
Exactly. And Nyens isn't like this no doubt defender. So that sort of adds a little bit of leaves the door open a little bit for a guy like Frey. I think the other one we talked about is Kevin Alvarez. If he comes stateside and does the Cardinals, does what Rynel Rodriguez did this year, where he answers some questions about the defensive abilities, maybe not clear cut, but like there's more here than we thought there was. And he hits like that, really produces, replicates those DSL numbers, and maybe shows a little bit more raw pop as he gets bigger, stronger, is training here, over a full off season in Palm Beach. I think he's another guy, he's a left-handed, hitter with a good balance of skills. and a lot of power projection as a 6'4" guy that you know has the physical frame, 25 to 30 pounds of good weight over the next 5 to 6 years, he's a guy that can make that step. Then I think my outlier here, my outside one, is Ryan Furcucci, who I talked about. You know, it's a plus fastball. It's an above average slider. Some people have put pluses on that. He threw a ton of strikes and was a guy that really landed it to you know, targeting zones and kind of zoning his pitches and tunneling and doing all those things. There's a pitchability element with this. He's a bigger guy. It's good stuff. We'll see how it translates. He's coming off, you know, close to 2 years of no real game action, you know, outside of the stuff that was going on in the fall. On the backfields and stuff, they more or less told me that if, you know, he had been healthier or 1 month ahead of where he was, he probably would have gotten into games in August and September. They didn't want him to debut in the fall league, which I think with any pitching prospect that you value and doesn't already have some pro track record, probably a good move. So I think he's a guy that could certainly pitch his way, you know, into that conversation. It is the Astros, though. They do move these guys pretty fast. There's also a chance that maybe he's somebody that is like a blue ball that has, you know, 30 or 40 innings and just qualifies for the handbook and might be in the number one consideration because, you know, maybe he made some starts down the stretch and looked really, really good. We saw that this year with Nolan McLean and Trey Savage and some others. So, yeah, I think those are the ones that I would cue in on because I think Bryce Matthews could graduate. I think blue ball will almost certainly graduate. I don't think Petco or Yannick have that sort of upside. And I like Bryce Meyer, but I'm not ready to go there either.
So to our final question on the video portion of this, when we talk about the Astros and we say, what are they good at developing? I feel like you almost have to kind of divide this because I mean, we just had a piece up at Baseball America recently looking at international production 2012 to present, I should say. And the Astros did extremely well in that. A lot of what you just talked about as the lead into this, when we talk about that pitching staff that they had in the World Series and all that, and it was, I would say that if you said over the last 15 years, no organization has done a better job of developing international starting pitchers signed on the international amateur market. Largely, I would say a group of them who were often signed for low money, for low cost bonuses, and were not 16 at the time, kind of that 17, 18-year-old case, and then develop them and they blossom into, again, successful, productive, long-term big league starters, which is, I think, for all of that, we talked about that lineup, but was such a key part of the success of those Astros teams. And really, I would say if you said what allowed them to sustain their success, right? Because you had the first wave with the Astros, which includes like Carlos Beltran, in addition to, you know, the hitters we talked about, you've got Justin Verlander acquired in trade. You've got, you know, Dallas Keuchel. You got all that. And then as those guys kind of aged out, left in free agency, or in the case of Lance McCullers Jr., kept struggling to stay healthy, it was the arrival of the Framber Valdezes, the Luis Garcias, the Ronel Blancos, the Christian Javiers. We could just go down the list. But that's kind of a previous iteration of the Astros at this point, is it not? Like, what is, I would say, so to add slightly to this, what do you think this current iteration of the Astros, because that was kind of the tail end of the Jeff Lunau regime, that was, you know, the Azacampo, you know, the international director and guys like that, what do you think is the current Astros iteration good at developing?
Yeah, I think we have to see, because there was, you know, some hangover in terms of the front office personnel, the analysts, the player development people, a lot of the coach staff. That was left over from Lunau into the Click regime, into the Dana Brown regime. We've started to see those guys matriculate out to other organizations, et cetera, over the last 2 or 3 years. I think particularly over the last like 24 months. So that's had an impact on it. So it's tough to know. And I think they're kind of in this transitional period. It feels like it's more of the tooled up hitter, position player that has one really outlier tool, Nyans. Cam Smith, I think, falls into that. Ethan Frey falls into that. Bryce Matthews falls into that. maybe Alvarez, and developing those guys, you know, into everyday players. I think a lot of the times with the players that they've gone after, it's kind of refining that hit tool because we know they're good athletes, they're good runners, they get on base, they have power. And then it's just a matter of developing that hit tool. I think we saw it somewhat with the Jeremy Peña. Cam Smith, I mean, a lot of it was the fly. He had very little minor league time, as little as we've seen just about with a position player. And he struggled at points in time last year. So I think the verdict is still out. But I would probably lean into it. Seems like, at least on the acquisition side, they're going more into these higher upside position type players with a lot of tools. And then it's kind of refining the hit tool. Bryce Matthews certainly kind of screams that. And that was sort of the beginning of this group that's in charge of the amateur side of things and the acquisition side of things. That was kind of like their first draft, not fully. The next year was kind of the fully, the more Forcucci year, etc. But I think it's probably those type of players.
If you want to hear more about that, we're going to keep talking exactly about that on the podcast portion of this. But if you're watching on the YouTube, you can check out the podcast feed for an additional probably 20 minutes or so of Astros discussion. But we do thank you for watching the Baseball America video, on the YouTube channel. But if you're on the podcast, we'll just keep rolling along right after this quick break.
Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records in the internet and then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace making money off of your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura's online security capabilities have allowed me to feel safe when it comes to my online presence. Aura fights back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal. It is a full digital security suite that protects every part of your life online. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. Aura also removes what is already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That's enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove and get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details.
And we're back. So going a little bit further into that, Jeff, how has, like you said, that this is now the Dana Brown Astros, right? And that was kind of a transitionary period, right? Because you had the Jeff Lunau Astros, and then you had the James Click Astros, and then there was a lot of turnover there in a multi-year part piece of time. But now Dana Brown's been around long enough, has had this kind of been running things long enough that this is kind of his Astros front office. How do you think, like, when you look at that? Again, you're literally trying to hint, pick out pieces and hints from things, because we're still relatively early on in Dana Brown running the Astros. But what are you seeing so far that is both what is similar maybe and what is different from what we've seen under past Astros regimes?
Yeah. I think a lot of sort of those under the radar moves that they consistently made, whether that was the under the radar, low dollar amount international signings that turned into a lot of good pitchers, Framber Valdez, Christian Javier, Blanco, a whole, gang of others. We haven't seen those. We haven't seen any sort of Yordan Alvarez trade where they're finding this hidden jewel. And frankly, that might be harder to do in 2025, 2024, 2025, 2026 than it was 10 years ago. I mean,
I think that there are like three trades that have essentially ruined that trade, right?
Yeah.
You can't making that trade in 2026. The one, the number one on that list would be Fernando Tatis Jr., right? You trade an aging, expensive veteran for Fernando Tatis Jr., and you're not going to live that one down. You just mentioned Josh Fields, who was productive briefly for the Dodgers, but Josh Fields for Yordan Alvarez, who had not played a game in pro ball yet, but you're going to, that one leaves a mark. And then I would say Junior Caminero for Tobias Myers is the third one, where now, if you're a GM or a president of baseball operations and you want to make that deal and you have that target that you want, who's in the DSL, I feel like that you can't mention that name until you've gone through like 17 other iterations. If you just say, hey, you want to make this deal? Yeah, we like so-and-so who's in the DSL. They're just saying no. But you're going to have to be like much more like, yeah, we like so-and-so. No, 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 no. Well, what about so-and-so? He's far away. He's in the DSL. I do think that GMs, for one, I do think that now they actually do have to pay more attention to what, you know, that it used to be viewed as that's far away. That's not going to come back and bite me usually. But two, I really do think that those trades are like, oh, I can't be, I would rather just reflexively say no than get jobbed by one of those trades, which will kind of hang around, you know, like, you know, it'll be a stench that kind of sticks with me for years to come.
Yeah, you know, I think that's, you know, totally accurate and probably one of the reasons you're not seeing, you know, the Astros be able to pull off a deal like that, which is totally fine. Now, you know, I think that the Luna one is a really difficult comparison because you went from sort of the lowest of lows when he took over and implementing processes and really being on the cutting edge of so many things that were to come in the game, that, you know, he kind of operated it in a different manner, and they were able to acquire and develop a very much homegrown core. I mean, like, you even look at like the 2019 team, you know, Yuli Gurriel, they signed, right? Jose Altuve, homegrown, Carlos Correa, homegrown, Alex Bregman, homegrown. You know, Yordan Alvarez, maybe not technically homegrown, but for all
90% homegrown.
95% homegrown, George Springer. You know, you have sort of all of those bats that were constantly coming up. You know, at this point in time, you know, they had Laureano was in this system. Teoscar Hernandez around this time, a few years before that, was in this system. So they were constantly kind of hitting on guys like that. There was always more depth than I think you even realized. I'm not so sure that that's the case any longer. I think some of that is the international side of things. Some of that is the trading side of things has changed. They're leaning, I think, more into acquiring a lot of their young players via the draft. They're much, much more aggressive in trading away players that they've drafted. That was certainly something under Lou Now and his regime. And we've kind of seen that play out with Elias and Sig during their time in Baltimore. They were not an organization that wanted to give up prospects for horses. You know, they believed in the prospects. They wanted to have as many players that they had drafted and acquired, you know, as minor leaguers that came through the system and developed and pushed their way through. And then they went to free agency and they walked and they had a whole new group of guys to fill it in. That, I mean, you read any of the books that have been written about this time in Houston, that is a very consistent theme. I think that has very much changed. And I think that, I don't want to say panic, but I do think that there are times now that they are making deals that they would not have made in previous years and mortgaging the future a little bit in order to get that right now player. Yeah, they've been more aggressive just in terms of making trades. Like, I don't think the previous regime would have made that Verlander trade with Clifford and Gilbert. And to their credit, they didn't win a World Series. They got to ALCS and they lost to the Rangers. I don't think it killed them though. It's not like those are two guys that would have been no doubt starting in their outfield. Drew Gilbert is still a fringy major leaguer at this point. You know, maybe he's a 45. It still remains to be seen.
It's kind of the power of going back to Tony V.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what it is. He's going to break it. He's going to break him out. He's going to be playing, you know, crazy. He was already a fun player. Right. but I don't think one that's like, they're not kicking themselves that they made that trade. And I think, you know, that's a difference. The way the organization is run is much more in the short term than it was in the long term. And I think that they're leaning more in the draft. They've made some changes in the international side. So we'll see how this class comes to fruition. And if, you know, the next few change that and they're able to find someone's undervalued sort of signings. But it's really tough to know that until you're 3 years out from a signing class more often than not. Because those guys needed time to develop and gel and all those sort of things. So it's different. You know, I don't want to be overly negative, but, you know, this was one of the more successful player development stories in history, regardless of the cheating allegations and all that sort of stuff. They were a very successful program that, you know, put together a lot of talent that there's going to be some Hall of Famers and guys that'll be on that ballot, right? Like, we're going to end up voting on a lot of these names that were on those 2017, 2018, 2019 teams, even through 2022. So, yeah, you know, it will be interesting to see how this all comes together in the next few years. I think the Burroughs trade was a good trade. Some of these other moves that they've made, but it's going to be interesting to see if they can sustain this.
So kind of along those lines, you've hit on a couple of these guys already, but if you want to expound more on Ryan Ferrucci, for example, you can, but who are some sleepers that you like?
I'll actually say that this was probably one of my favorite 11 to like 15 groups. and of course, before that, you know, before the trade, Ferrucci was in that. Miguel Yola was in that. They're now inside the top 10. But there's one player in particular that I'm fascinated by, and that is Lucas Spence. He was a undrafted free agent. Debuted, you know, signed after the 2024 draft out of Southern Illinois, Edwardsville. You know, was a JUCO guy, a two-way player for a couple years before that. You know, while he was at Southern Illinois, hit 385, 473, 552, made 14 appearances on the mound. He's now a full-time position player for the first time in his career and had a pretty good year. I mean, the slash line 244, 368, 403 doesn't look overly impressive, but I think when you consider, you know, went from low A, which I know it's low A, it's not the easiest place to hit, high A, made some swing adjustments to add a little bit more loft, gets up to double A, and, you know, was impressive. A really good athlete. Another guy who is, you know, a plus runner, above average in center field, can play all three outfield positions. In a lot of ways, he's kind of a poor man's Jacob Melton, a former JUCO guy before he went to Oregon State and, you know, was stayed an extra year in college from when he could have been drafted. So, you know, I think there's some parallels there. Obviously, there's a lot more pedigree with a guy like Melton, but I do see some similarities. The angles are the biggest question. He hits the ball harder than you think. He makes a ton of contact. The swing decisions are pretty good. He's a really interesting player. He's a guy that I could come back to a year from now and say, this guy's maybe a 45 or a 50 and, you know, might develop into their next sort of, you know, and I know Chaz McCormick hasn't gone great and Jake Myers hasn't gone great and all, you know, but they've been big leaguers. You know, I think there's a conversation to be had. Are they 45s? Maybe in the right seasons, they were 50s. It wouldn't shock me if he turns into that. I think that he is, by the definitions, very much a true sleeper, a guy that came from not a lot of a pedigree in the background that performed right away, moved a bunch of levels, is now age appropriate, has tools, has some polished skills. This could go somewhere, and this is an interesting player. So he's one in particular that I would call out.
So the last thing to kind of, before we wrap this up, you've touched on this also a little bit too, but you've kind of been hinting about this. Like, if you look at this organization where it is right now, farm system wise, you could construct a case that says this is about as bad as it gets right now if you're ranking all 30 organizations as far as talent. And you would, that would largely be based on the top end is not comparable to most farm systems right now, especially post-trade. There are not as many top 100 prospects here. There have not been as many top 100 prospects here as there are in most organizations in recent years. But you and I've talked about it, and you've kind of hinted on here. Again, not that we're trying to just put on rose-colored glasses here to talk about this, but what is it about this and where the Astros are right now that kind of has you encouraged about kind of this farm system and kind of where it could go?
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of guys that we can call out with upside, and it's kind of throughout the list. We talked about Nines. We talked about Frey. We talked about Kevin Alvarez. We talked about Ryan Fercucci. We talked about, you know, Lucas Spence. Zach Cole, I don't think it's going to sustain in the big leagues, but Zach Cole wasn't bad in his short sample at the end of the season. There's a lot of swing and miss. It's kind of a Spencer Jones-ish kind of profile with a different type of body, but maybe equal athleticism and outputs, you know, in terms of the power and some of those things. I think you even look at guys like Joseph Sullivan, Anthony Huezo. There's a lot of upside with those guys. We don't really know what we've gotten with Jace Mitchell yet. They're just continuing. There's continuously guys in this system that have upside. And then after the trades, I had a couple of guys, and it's always tough with some of these DSL players that aren't super performers. And Anthony Milan, an outfielder that debuted, he was a signing out of Venezuela for a little bit under $500,000 in January 2025. He had a phenomenal year in the DSL for the Astros, 279, 407, 419. The underlying EVs are pretty good. There's decent enough bat to ball ability and some swing decisions. He's a decent athlete, you know, a plus runner, guy that can play all three outfield positions. Again, a risky player, not the biggest body, but I think you look at that and you're like, all right, that's kind of exciting. I haven't seen that with the Astros in a while. Someone that I actually believed in, where the underlying data backed some of the hype that I was getting from guys that had seen him. Because I think sometimes with, you know, evaluators that cover particular systems, especially ones that toward the back end are a little bit thinner, like the Astros have been in years, they're searching for guys. You had your Herman Ramirez's and some of these other guys who are on the list. And then the other one is Omar Damian, who actually did make Josh's DSL list, if I'm not mistaken. Another guy signed out of the DR in 2025, under $400,000, but decent signing, really like a lot of IVB, interesting pitch mix, really good changeup. I don't know how much command is there, but you never know. He's 6'2 with some projection remaining. I think he's kind of interesting. So I think like I have some enthusiasm because I can dream on this system a little more than I used to, where it was like, I see a lot of relievers, a lot of number five starters, and a lot of fourth outfielders. And that's kind of what it was for a lot of years, which was, you know, help them sustain what they were able to do. By the same token, by the trade deadline, if things go well with some of these guys that we've talked about, they could have three or four players that are interesting trade chips for teams, you know, as whether it's as a lead player or some of those secondary and fiduciary players that get added to bigger deals. They might be able to go out there and do that. I don't think they've really been able to outside of the older expiring vets that might be expensive that they're willing to take on the expense of.
So that is our look at the Houston Astros farm system, a system that is very interesting in a lot of different ways, has made some changes and all that, and is one, as Jeff laid out, that'll be very interesting to watch in 2026 because there are some players here who could pop. If you enjoyed this one, we have deep dives either out, a lot of teams already, or coming for every organization, all 30 MLB organizations. We are rolling these out fast and furious. By the way, we also have the top 100. We're going to take a deep dive break for at least a day because we have some top 100 videos to give you and produce. Also, producing is a key part of that as well. So you hope, okay, if you're enjoying any of these and I don't feel like you're going to be angry at us because we're giving you top 100 prospect content on the podcast feed. So for Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.